The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Democrats, the whole time, were sort of mostly clear that, you know, they definitely wanted to support assistance to Ukraine. The politics of supporting assistance to Israel without additional conditions on how the Israelis use that aid, that has gotten more complicated over time.
It's the Lawfare podcast. I'm Catherine Pompilio, associate editor of Lawfare, with Molly Reynolds, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and senior editor at Lawfare.
I think it is possible that we will see a vote on a resolution declaring the speakership vacant. So the same mechanism from the floor that we saw against McCarthy. I think it's possible we'll see that against Johnson.
Today, we're talking about the story of the national security package legislation in Congress. So, Molly, there's obviously a lot going on, or a lot has been going on in Congress. And most recently, President Biden just signed the national security package into law amongst, you know, everything else that's happening. Let's unpack this piece of legislation. What's the purpose of it? How many bills are in it? Can you please just explain it to me?
Sure. So the legislation that the House and the Senate passed and that President Biden has now signed into law has four parts. So one part involves providing additional assistance to Ukraine. One part involves providing additional assistance to Israel. There's also some money in there for humanitarian assistance in Gaza and the ability to use that money in other places around the world as well. There is some additional assistance for mainly for Taiwan under the heading of the Indo-Pacific. And then there is a fourth kind of catch-all piece of legislation. I would say the other three bills or other three components are largely about money. So it's largely about additional U.S. dollars being spent in ways to support these strategic priorities. And then there is a fourth component that has some other changes in law that also support the U.S.'s interests in these areas around the world. That is the component of the legislation that includes what folks have been referring to as the quote-unquote TikTok ban. You can talk more about this later. It's more accurately described as a requirement that TikTok's owner divest of its stake in TikTok at some point over the next year out of concerns around Chinese influence in the ownership of that company. That fourth element of the package also includes some language related to sanctions policy. It includes some language related to seized Russian assets. It includes some legislation related to data brokers. So it's really sort of it's kind of the policy change piece that goes along with these three spending elements, again, that are largely about Ukraine, about Israel, and about Taiwan.
I feel like we could do a separate podcast on each separate one.
I think some of that may be in the works. We have a lot of really great Lawfare coverage, so I'll point listeners to written content on the web on a number of these pieces, including there's a great piece from Justin Sherman on the data brokers legislation that helped me understand what was going on there. And so, yes, there's a lot that's substantively interesting to our Lawfare podcast listeners in this package. I think today we'll mainly be talking about sort of the politics and kind of how we got here. But do know that for those of you who are interested in the substance, there's a lot there, and more is coming down the pike from us on that front.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, like you said, how we got here. What's the story of this legislation? Tell us all about the congressional gossip. Where do we begin?
So if we're going to take the story back to September, which I think is a reasonable place to start, in September, Congress was facing down a deadline to keep the government open. October 1st is the start of the new fiscal year. The measure funding most federal operations was going to run out at that point. In August, the Biden administration had sent to Congress a supplemental funding request that included additional assistance for Ukraine, additional assistance for Taiwan, and at that point, some additional financial commitments, so additional spending to address the situation on the U.S.'s southern border. And at that point, sort of the Biden administration's thinking was, if we ask for aid to Ukraine in conjunction with two other things that are important to segments of the Republican conference, maybe that's kind of the magic sauce. Maybe that's how we get this across the finish line, because as we know, even by that point, support among folks in the Republican conference, especially in the House, but to some degree in the Senate, was starting to wane. And so the Biden administration made this request, and they were hoping that the supplemental funding request with the assistance to Ukraine in particular would get paired with a measure to keep the government open past October 1st. That did not happen. The original sort of plan, I think, was that the Senate would act first, and the Senate, where there was stronger support among the Senate Republican Conference, particularly on the part of Leader McConnell for assistance to Ukraine, that the Senate would take the continuing resolution to keep the government open, tie it together with this supplemental funding package, pass it and send it to the House, and sort of try and jam the House before the government funding deadline. The schedule slipped a little bit and the Senate didn't get that done. And then the House managed, despite sort of a number of internal difficulties, to approve a bill keeping the government open that did not have any aid to Ukraine in it. And I think what Kevin McCarthy thought at the time, obviously I'm not inside his head, is that if they sent that to the Senate, a sort of government funding only bill, no money for Ukraine, that the Senate would not accept that, and then we would have a government shutdown, and he would be able to blame it on Democrats for wanting more aid to Ukraine at the expense of keeping the government open at home. Instead, Senate Republicans in particular kind of rebelled on Leader McConnell and said, no, we will accept this. We are not going to hold out for more aid to Ukraine now. We want to keep the government open. This is not so important to us. Some of us oppose it. And so we will not be behind you if you try to hold up this bill keeping the government open over Ukraine. So the government stayed open. There was no aid for Ukraine. And there was enough anger within the House Republican Conference that this became the precipitating event for deposing Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. So here we are, beginning of October, the government is open, we have no Speaker, we have no aid to Ukraine. Because it then took the House basically 3 weeks and several false starts on several other Speaker candidates to coalesce around Speaker Johnson. We get to, and while this is happening, is when Hamas attacks Israel. That happens October 7th. So all of a sudden, there's another global crisis on the agenda. So once Johnson is finally elected Speaker, he is faced with this question of what to do about the new crisis in Israel, as well as what to do about keeping the government open and providing possibly additional assistance to Ukraine. There's a long period of time where there is an insistence on the part of Republicans, particularly in the House, that they will not approve any additional assistance to Ukraine without major changes to immigration law and policy, largely in the form of a bill that they had passed earlier in the year. Responding to that demand, Senate Republicans, mainly Leader McConnell, says, okay, let's see if we can do something on this. We sort of deputizes Jim Lankford, who is a conservative Republican, to negotiate with Chris Murphy, who's a Democrat, and Kyrsten Sinema over possible immigration law changes. That happens. And then they, you know, reach a compromise. And within like 48 hours, it is clear that that avenue for pursuing additional assistance to Ukraine, as well as aid to Israel and aid to Taiwan, is dead in the water, that Republicans in the House will not accept the border policy changes that Murphy and Lankford and Sinema have negotiated. So at this point, sort of people are asking, are we ever going to get this done? And then by mid-March, when Congress finally managed to find a way to keep the government open for the rest of this year to pass a final spending deal for the balance of the year, then they were kind of able to turn to this question of, can we get something that provides assistance to Ukraine and assistance to Israel, and possibly some other things, which we ended up seeing packaged in, across the finish line. So this is obviously a long story, and I think we're going to talk in a little bit about some elements of the end game that actually go back to McCarthy's original election as Speaker. But I do think it's really important to sort of anchor our understanding of what happened now within kind of the circumstances that generated McCarthy's ouster in September as well.
Absolutely. And just for some additional context as we move through this story that for me is kind of like whacking through weeds because there's so many moving parts. Why is Republican support for Ukraine aid waning? What's going on there? And then two, before he was elected Speaker, what was Johnson's views on Ukraine aid?
Yeah, these are both great questions. So I think the story of kind of the waning support in the Republican conference, especially in the House, but to some degree in the Senate over time, is just some degree it's about Trump, and Trump himself has over time sort of repeatedly come out against additional assistance to Ukraine, or at least sort of in the form that Congress has been considering it. You know, he at various points, you know, floated the idea of having it be a loan. There is actually a little bit of what made it into the package that is a forgivable loan. It's not a particularly large part of the assistance to Ukraine, but it is there. I think there's reason to think that sort of that tweak was made as at least a little bit of symbolic cover for some of the folks who are kind of more Trump aligned. So that's one piece of it. And then I think more broadly, and it's a little difficult to separate this entirely from Trump, but we have seen this kind of growing isolationist wing of the Congressional Republican Party. And so again, some of that is probably related to Trump directly. Some of it's less related to Trump. It's sort of hard to say, but you sort of take that and then you combine it with the fact that obviously, this is a very big priority for the Biden administration. And whenever in our kind of current era of polarized parties, whenever you have something that's really important to a president of the other party, including now increasingly foreign policy questions, there's some just kind of reactive energy against what an opposite party president wants from members of the other party in Congress. So I think sort of that's how I would understand this. I will say that while we saw some decline kind of going up to September of last year in Republican support, so there were more Republican votes against assistance to Ukraine in September than there had been earlier in the summer, the size of the anti-Ukraine bloc in the House Republican conference in April was about the same size as it was in September. So we haven't actually seen, at least as measured by votes, a whole lot of movement in the past 6 months in comparison to the period before that. As for Mike Johnson, and we could talk more about this generally, one of the really interesting things to contemplate about Speaker Johnson is that because he was not an especially high-profile member of the Republican leadership before he became kind of an improbable speaker, we actually don't have a great sense of where his own kind of personal convictions on Ukraine were before this all unfolded. And so that created a lot of uncertainty over time. So obviously we knew where Leader McConnell stood very strongly. He's been very vocal in support of Ukraine since the invasion. But we just had less of a sense of where Johnson was personally, which on one hand meant that it was kind of hard to pin down where he might be going. But possibly on the other hand, gave him a little bit more kind of cover as he maneuvered through these negotiations, since there was not quite the same sense of what was kind of driving him personally.
Yeah. I guess this might be asking the same question, but could you just characterize the split between GOP leadership? You know, why was McConnell supporting this so strongly, and why is Johnson so opposed? Is he afraid of the Freedom Caucus, or what's going on?
So a lot of that has to do with the I'll start by saying that I think, to Mitch McConnell's credit, certainly from a like pro-democracy, anti-Russian aggression perspective, he has been very clear the whole time that it is important for the U.S. to support Ukrainians and their efforts to counter Russian aggression, because that is doing so means like living up to American pro-democracy values worldwide. And this is an important thing that the U.S. should be doing as a NATO country, and just all of the kind of strategic foreign policy reasons to be supportive of the Ukrainians, and that means spending U.S. tax dollars to do this. And so McConnell has not wavered in his personal commitment to that that position. And I think when we think about sort of how did we finally get this over the line, I do think that's an important part of the story. Also, the way that McConnell gets his job as the Republican leader in the Senate, and the way that Mike Johnson gets his job as the Republican leader in the House, are very different. This is true even before McConnell announced earlier this year that he was not going to stand for election as Republican leader again in the Senate. So a little bit, he's a lame duck as the Republican leader. I think it was an open question for a while whether that meant he was going to be more or less powerful in trying to get Ukraine across the finish line. I don't know that we have a clear answer to that, but it certainly has not affected his own personal commitment to trying to get this done. So in the Senate, to be elected as the leader of one of the two parties, you simply need a majority of the votes of your party members. Those are selections that happen within the two parties. So when McConnell stood for election as Republican leader the last time, he just needed a majority of the Republicans. In the House, however, because the speakership is a constitutional office, you need a majority of the entire chamber who are voting on the question of who should be the next speaker to vote for you. And as we saw in January of 2023, as we saw in October of 2023, when you have a very narrow majority, as Republicans do, and when that majority is very divided on some questions, if it can be very difficult unless you have help from the minority party, which, and we'll get to this, we have yet to actually see, but may well be coming, to either elect the speaker or keep that speaker in his or her office, then you really just don't have that much room to maneuver. And so I am skeptical that Johnson will ultimately lose his speakership job over bringing this to the floor. We can talk about why I think that is. But fundamentally, the calculus is just different for the two. In addition to sort of their possible personal differences of opinion around how important this is, but just structurally, it's a different calculus to get and stay leader in the Senate than it is to get and stay the Speaker of the House.
All right, let's dive in. So February 2024, the Senate, as you mentioned, the Senate passes the $95 billion aid package with assistance for Ukraine and Israel. It's a moment of bipartisanship. I'm imagining, you know, the rare image of Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell triumphantly working together. And then the bill goes to the House. What does Johnson and the Republicans say about the bill when it arrives on the House floor? And what kind of dynamic does this that set up with the Senate and the House?
So at this point, we are still at least a little bit in a world where there's a lot of skepticism about whether anything can get through the House without border provisions. And remember that what the House Republicans had been demanding on the border is more substantial than what a bipartisan group of senators had negotiated their way to sort of in the end of 2023, the beginning of 2024. It's worth saying that what Murphy and Sinema and Lankford agreed to is a more substantial change to immigration law than really had been on the table in any number of other attempts to reach bipartisan immigration compromises in the last decade. Democrats in that negotiation were really willing to give away more than they had been willing to in the past. And that was still not enough for the House Republicans, who were really pushing for there to be immigration law changes as part of this package. I think it's worth contemplating the degree to which people were sort of acting in good or bad faith here. I do think there's some element of Republicans in the House in particular knowing that they're never going to get what they want, and there being, for some of them, some political value in sort of trying to hold out for the most ideological position that they can, even though they know they're never going to get it. This gets into sort of the dynamics of Republicans versus the dynamics of Democrats. But that is basically where we were at the beginning of, or, you know, late February, early March, once this had come over from the Senate.
So is the Senate bill dead on arrival? What happens with all of this?
Yeah, so I think on one level, it was the sort of, if not dead on arrival, but certainly on ice. I think another kind of important thing to think about here is that, as I mentioned earlier, at this same time, the House and the Senate are trying to resolve funding for the rest of the government for the rest of the fiscal year. That was not an easy lift. There were lots of disputes about overall levels in those bills, about specific programs, in some cases about specific projects that were being directed to particular community organizations. So that was happening. Looming after those deadlines was the need to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. We'll talk about that, I think, a little bit at the very end. And so there, while sort of in the same time period when this was coming over from the Senate and there was not a lot of appetite to act on this in the House, there are these other things that are taking up Congress's energy that also have really hard deadlines, and that if Congress doesn't meet those deadlines, the consequences of doing so are pretty significant. I think one really important overarching point about why this all took so long, like why did it take so long to get to yes on Ukraine, is because while for Ukrainians and for the conduct of their operations against Russia, this delay has been very consequential. But from the perspective of Congress, there was not some kind of hard deadline or hard cliff where if they don't act by this date, there is some big consequence for kind of Congress itself. And we know that in kind of the current era, Congress is very deadline driven. And so in one level, it was that, you know, every day was a deadline for Ukraine. But when every day was a deadline, then no day is a deadline. So there wasn't the same kind of external action forcing mechanism that existed for a couple of other things that were on Congress's plate at the same time.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at UH1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
Okay, so then April 2024, this brings us to, I guess, this month, Johnson releases text on his foreign aid plan. How did we get here? What was going on with on the foreign aid side with, you know, Democrats and Hakeem Jeffries? What's going on internally with the Republicans? And how does it differ? How does the legislation differ from the one passed by the Senate?
So the funding piece of the foreign assistance package looks almost exactly the same. It's very similar to the one that the Senate had passed. There is this small difference that I mentioned earlier about the piece of assistance to Ukraine that's now structured as a forgivable loan And then we have sort of the policy changes that are in like the fourth part of the bill that are, in a number of cases, were things that had been deliberated over in both the House and the Senate, even if they hadn't been sort of fully passed by both chambers. They're things that committees had had hearings on. So the TikTok legislation falls into this category. There's some language about the cease to combat fentanyl trafficking that had been deliberated on. There is something called the Repo Act, which involves using seized Russian assets that had been deliberated on. So there's a number of things in there that aren't new ideas, but that sort of do get packaged in with the assistance in an attempt, I think, to help sort of get it across the finish line, that there are some things that folks find attractive politically, substantively. And so the funding piece looks mostly the same. And Democrats the whole time were sort of mostly clear that, you know, they definitely wanted to support assistance to Ukraine. The politics of supporting assistance to Israel without additional conditions on how the Israelis use that aid, that has gotten more complicated over time. And we'll talk about sort of a little bit about how we ultimately got around that hurdle. But substantively, the Democratic votes, particularly on the Ukraine piece, were always there. Where I think things started to change for Johnson is I think he started to feel more pressure from the pro-Ukraine component of the Republican conference, which is smaller but influential vis-a-vis the anti-Ukraine contingent. Sometimes we talk about the three mics, which is to say the chairs of several of the relevant national security committees in the House, all of whom happen to be named Mike. And so these folks in the Republican conference, I think we're starting to put some pressure on Johnson. There's reporting that says that the Biden administration this whole time was keeping up steady, if quiet, pressure on Johnson, doing things like showing him a lot of intelligence that he would not have been privy to before he was elected speaker, to really try and convince him of the seriousness of not doing this. Like, what are the consequences if we don't provide additional assistance to Ukraine? And then I think we eventually reached a point where we were sitting on the edge of another congressional recess. The House managed to figure out its 702 reauthorization. If you want a detailed blow-by-blow on how that happened, I can refer you to another Lawfare podcast that that I did. But eventually, we got to a point where Johnson was feeling like he needed to act, and so then he had to come up with a plan on how to do that.
And what does his bill say about border provisions?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. Why did I not mention that? Because there really isn't anything in there. So like that piece, certainly the part about all of these demands from House Republicans, all of the language that the bipartisan group of senators had negotiated, all those changes to immigration policy just got left by the wayside. And the U.S. Congress continues its decade-long struggle to find a way to make any serious substantive changes to immigration policy.
And can you also just clue us in on what the bill said about TikTok as well?
So in about a year, there's an initial period that can be then extended by the president. Basically, TikTok needs to be divested of its Chinese ownership. And if that does not happen, then it can't be sold in sort of the major app stores, or can't be made available in the major app stores. And so that getting to that point took some negotiating, particularly between the two chambers. So particularly around the period of time before which divestment would have to happen. Sort of the House's initial proposal, I think, was shorter. And then it's a concession to the Senate, particularly Maria Cantwell, who's the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, that got extended. And so that piece is in the legislation. There is also, it got paired with this legislation that I mentioned earlier that prohibits foreign adversaries from buying Americans' personal data from data brokers. Sort of those two things together got put in that additional package.
Okay, so Johnson releases the text of the bill, And then it ends up facing a key procedural rules committee roadblock. Can you explain what this is and what the holdup was and what needed to be done?
I would love nothing more than to explain the House Rules Committee to Lawfare Podcast listeners. So in the House of Representatives, the Rules Committee usually functions as what we might call kind of a traffic cop between the Speaker and the majority leadership's legislative priorities and what actually happens on the floor. So generally, when something substantive is going to be taken up by the House, it'll first go to the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee will decide how long does that get debated? Will the bill be open for amendment? If it's open for amendment, will just anyone be able to amend it? Or will the Rules Committee specify, here are the amendments that are going to get offered, and here's who's going to offer them? Because it is a tool of the majority party leadership, the majority party has a supermajority membership on the committee. So right now, there are 12 members on the committee. And when Kevin McCarthy was seeking the speakership last year, one of the concessions that he made to the Freedom Caucus and sort of their allies in that faction of the conference was to put three members who kind of represent the interests of that faction on the Rules Committee. These three members announced that they were not going to support Johnson's effort to bring the bills to the floor, these sort of four bills, which meant that if the bill was going to come through the Rules Committee, then it would need some of the Democrats, at least some of the Democrats on the Rules Committee, to vote with the Republicans. That has happened historically. There's actually a period, there have been periods where we've seen lots of bipartisanship on the Rules Committee. It is in recent history, in the last, decade or two, it is very unusual for members of the minority party to vote for a rule to come out of the Rules Committee. And it is even more unusual for them to do it in a way that's decisive. So in a way that means that if the minority didn't vote with some members of the majority, then the rule wouldn't carry. And so I want to be clear, this is not an unprecedented occurrence, what we saw, but in the current environment, it's very unusual. And so the rule came out of the Rules Committee at a 9-3 vote. So five Republicans, so sort of the Johnson allies on the committee, and the four Democrats voted together, and there were no votes came from the three folks who McCarthy had agreed to put on the Rules Committee. And then when the rule came to the floor, it also needed Democratic help to pass. So when it came to and that is also unusual in the current environment. We saw it happen last year on the rule for the measure to raise the debt ceiling, but again, generally, an expectation of the majority party is that all the members of the majority party vote for a rule. An expectation of members of the minority party is that all the minority party members vote against the rule. This is sort of functional procedural politics in the House in this era. 9 months or so ago, a group of Republicans started throwing out the norm that they would support all of these procedural votes from things that their speaker wanted to do on the floor, which has made life very difficult for them. But it took, again, this happened with the debt ceiling vote, but this is another kind of unusual occurrence where Democrats on the floor were willing to save Republicans, basically, were willing to put up the votes to be able to do this. Once they cleared that procedural hurdle, then, as we've known sort of all along, there were all four of these measures had broad bipartisan support. Each one of them got more than 300 votes. The coalitions were not exactly the same. One political benefit of having broken this up into four pieces is that different members could vote for or against things that they, depending on how they felt about them. So, we saw some Democrats vote against the Israel piece out of concern, again, about the lack of conditions. and the Biden administration's posture towards Israel. So there were 37 Democratic no votes on that bill, again, mostly from the progressive wing of the party. But there were, on the Republican side, there were only 14 Republicans who voted against all of them. So, like, we always knew that once they got over, if they found a way to get over the procedural hurdle of actually bringing it to the floor, that the individual elements were really likely to have broad bipartisan support. And the last thing I'll say on kind of the math that I think is interesting is that when the measure went through the Rules Committee, I said one of the things they get to do is decide who gets to offer amendments. And that can be a really important kind of stage in the coalition building process. So sometimes what you do to try and get someone either to ultimately support something or just to not be as obstructive as they possibly can is you agree to give them a vote on an amendment that you know is not going to pass, that you give people an opportunity to take a position on something. So one of the amendments that we saw that was offered to the Ukraine bill that failed, and everyone knew it was going to fail, was an amendment from Marjorie Taylor Greene that would have sort of struck out all of the money for Ukraine. So was sort of an opportunity for the most vocal anti-assistance to Ukraine bloc to kind of make their voice heard. That amendment only got 71 Republican votes. So there is this set of House Republicans who we might think of as kind of a vote no, hope yes caucus. So people who, and this is a persistent dynamic over the last decade or so, that we see Republicans, particularly on certain issues, really not want to go on record as saying they're in favor of something, but ultimately we have reason to believe that they might actually at least be comfortable with it. And I think that's one of the things that this, the math on that Marjorie Taylor Greene amendment tells us.
Wow. So the package passes through the House and gets kicked back to the Senate. What are the initial reactions of Democratic and Republican leadership? What's the story of the legislation in the Senate?
Yeah, so I think it, because the sort of, I think, strength of support for assistance to Ukraine in the Senate has always been a little bit stronger than it's been in the House. I don't feel like it was ever, what was going to happen was ever really in doubt in the Senate. We did see some threats from a couple of Republican senators try and hold up the swift passage of the bill. But ultimately, even that didn't take that long, certainly by Senate standards. And there were a number of Republican senators who had voted against the Senate's version of the supplemental, which again looks almost identical to what was ultimately cleared. They had voted against the version back in February and then voted for this version. And so I think that, again, once we sort of saw the House figure out its way out of its box canyon on this, that it was much less of a challenge for the Senate to do the same.
And I just needed this to be on this podcast. McConnell characterized this tension as a Republican family argument.
So that is a long-standing description by a whole series of Republican leaders of the tensions that they face within their conferences. Paul Ryan used to use that term a lot to talk about how Republicans were having a family disagreement, or it was time for a family conversation. It is a weirdly consistent term of art that Republican leaders have used about the challenges that several of them, a whole series of them, have faced in negotiating particular tensions within their conferences.
Amazing. And so, not in the family, but what was Chuck Schumer and McConnell's working relationship like throughout all of this? Did it change from, the last bill in, I believe it was February, to now?
Yeah, so the reporting on this indicates that sort of the whole time McConnell and Schumer have been in, were sort of in pretty good communication around this, that they, despite their very significant differences on many other things, that this was a place where particularly in the context of getting this assistance to Ukraine across the finish line, was really important to both of them. And that even if they were sort of arguing about other things, that they were going to stay consistent on trying to get this done. Again, which I think reflects what now seems to us as a little bit of an old-fashioned bipartisan consensus around America's role in the world. But I do think that's really kind of what was at play here, is that they both agreed that this was a really vital national security priority. And so they were going to work together to figure out how to get it through the Senate.
And so April 23rd, the Senate overwhelmingly passes the package, which is the version we detailed at the beginning of this episode. But again, on the drama side of things, Johnson's passage of the bill in the House is prompting a lot of these same hardline, you know, Freedom Caucus members to potentially call for another, or to call for a vote to oust him. Are we right back where we started with McCarthy?
So I think it is possible that we will see a vote on a resolution declaring the speakership vacant. So the same mechanism from the floor that we saw against McCarthy. I think it's possible we'll see that against Johnson. I am at this point, at least when we are recording this podcast, much more skeptical that it will work against Johnson than it was against McCarthy. And I think that's sort of for two reasons. One, while there are a number of Republicans who are very angry at Mike Johnson, and given this narrowness of the House Republicans' majority, they may well have enough, if we were doing the vote strictly along party lines, they would have enough votes to oust Johnson. I think many, many other Republicans just simply do not want to relive the experience of trying to find a new speaker. I also think, and this is backed up by some reporting, that unlike in September, there are Democrats who may well be willing to vote to save Johnson's speakership. And I think that's sort of for two reasons. One is that unlike in September, the expectations of what else is going to happen during this Congress at this point are pretty low. You know, it's April, almost May. There's a presidential election in November. There are congressional elections. I don't think anyone has really high expectations for what else the Congress is going to do. And certainly, you know, things can happen and that would require congressional action. I do think one of the other things that helped kind of turn the tide in favor of support, Republican support for the foreign aid package, was that sort of changing circumstances on the ground in the Middle East. So sort of the Iran-Israel, the conflict, the kind of threat of broader aggression in the region, you know, wanting to avoid that. I think those kind of geopolitical circumstances also helped. And any number of things could happen over the next several months that would spur congressional action. But I think everyone's baseline expectations is that there isn't that much more high stakes negotiating to be done with Speaker Johnson. The other thing is that in September, McCarthy had managed to really deeply frustrate basically every element of the House Democratic Caucus. No one was happy with him. And even more importantly, no one trusted him. No one thought that if they put up the votes to save McCarthy, that they could count on him to deliver on any promise that they made to him in order to, or that he made to them, sorry, in order to get their votes. This time, Mike Johnson has already done the thing that Democrats would want him to do in order to save his speakership. You know, he resolved government funding for the rest of the year. He brought Ukraine aid to the floor. So there isn't quite the, in addition to just him not having done as much to make Democrats distrustful of him as McCarthy had done by the time they were faced with the prospect of saving McCarthy or not. Johnson has already done what basically Democrats were demanding McCarthy do if they were thinking about saving him. And so the calculus is just really different.
Okay. And I want to make sure we have time to talk about this because, as you mentioned before, you know, the aid package is not the only thing Congress has been up to. You, a few weeks ago, maybe last week, covered with, you know, Preston Marquis, Stephanie Pell, Ben, what is, you know, the House passed legislation to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. What happened with this legislation in the Senate since you did that podcast?
Yeah. So as I think I said at the end of the podcast, this is not not necessarily an I told you so moment, but it's a little bit I told you so moment. What I predicted is that while passage to the Senate was not entirely smooth, I was not as skeptical about its ability to get through the Senate than I had originally been about its ability to get through the House. And that is sort of, in fact, what we saw. They ran up right against the deadline. In fact, like went a little bit over the deadline. I think the last Republican senator voted at like 12:03 when midnight was the deadline, not to mention the part where it had to get sent on to the president for a signature. But while the same kind of dynamics that we saw in the House in terms of a coalition of kind of far right senators, along with some kind of privacy-minded Democratic senators, were very concerned about passing the bill, were trying to demand amendment votes, that sort of thing. Ultimately, Schumer and the Democratic leadership was able to negotiate their way through that minefield, and they were able to pass the 702 reauthorization.
And could you just tell me quickly, what were those provisions that the progressive and the conservative senators were, you know, trying to get in there? Are those powers too broad?
Yeah. So if you want to deep dive on this, I really would recommend going back to that podcast that I did with Stephanie and Preston and Ben, because we go pretty deep on this. But the biggest cleavage was around the existence of a warrant requirement under Section 702. So progressives and the kind of far-right Republicans, for different reasons, favor making it harder for the FBI to query information on U.S. persons in the context of these surveillance authorities. So that was, I would say, sort of the biggest obstacle, a second or potential obstacle. And a second thing that was a little bit at play, there was an amendment around the definition of basically electronic communication service providers that the House had adopted, that some senators were not big fans of. But frankly, in either of these cases, a warrant requirement or this definition or really anything else that the Senate might have changed or wanted to change, there was this threat, well, if you change anything, then it has to go back to the House. And the prospect, like, it was not easy to get through the House. We're coming up against the deadline. Amending it really isn't an option if we're not going to blow past the deadline. And if we send it back to the House, who knows if we could get it through the House again under any circumstances. So I think sort of those forces together are part of what helped drive it to passage.
Absolutely. And so I'm sure that, you know, just to wrap up, I'm sure that in a few months, and we're going to have another Molly WTF is going on in Congress. So what should listeners be looking to watching, you know, in Congress in the coming months?
As I sort of alluded to earlier, there's not that much that I think we should expect of Congress over the next several months. I will say that if you are a person who cares about the Farm Bill, which is the periodic major reauthorization of both agricultural support programs and also some really important nutrition assistance programs for kids and families, that may well be something Congress still tries to tackle. But certainly in the national security space, not nearly as much activity as we've seen so far. I will say that the appropriations process never ends. So even though it took until mid-March to resolve the appropriations process for the fiscal year that we're already in the middle of, the government will need to be kept open past October 1st. And so you've started to see some work on that process. You know, what are the levels of spending, that sort of thing. But I think by and large, not a lot of legislative activity. I do think that the Senate is likely to just continue attempting to confirm as many federal judges as they can process between now and the election. So for our listeners who are interested in that, certainly keep an eye on that. But we are certainly approaching the point where I think we should have lower expectations than what are many people's already low expectations of Congress.
I love it. All right, Molly, thank you so much for joining me. I learned so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Materials supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our theme song is from Alibi Music. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.